Sherry Bayet, talking to us about language of the heart, Chickasaw language reclamation as a life pursuit.
Mishiho, Sahochifo, Fanes, Ganose, Chikasha Saya, Chikasha Numba, Hatakatliha, M. Abachili. Hi, my name is Sherry Begay. I'm from the Chickasaw Nation and I am a language instructor.
Chukman, Sahochifo, Kerry Chu, Chikasha Saya, University of Arizona, Alcoa, Toksalili. My name is Kerry Chu and I'm a member of the Chickasaw Nation. I work for the Indigenous Teacher Education Project at the University of Arizona. And Sherry and I would both like to first thank the Hawaiian people who SLAM we're gathering on today. And we'd also like to thank our Chickasaw Governor, Bill Anitebi, for his very generous support of our work in this presentation, which explores why and how Chickasaw people dedicate themselves to the pursuit of language over the course of a lifetime.
Language is a gift to us from our Creator who gave us our voice. In the heart, it's the heart and soul of who we are as a people. And the power is in the words to convey what's in our hearts to others. Additionally, when we begin to speak the words of our language, we begin to understand more fully who we are inside and where we come from.
Through many conversations, Sherry and I have asked ourselves a critical question. And that's, what are our beliefs about language reclamation, and how do those beliefs inform our work? At its core, language reclamation is not so much about the language itself, but about the people. So we believe that our language, Chickasha Numpa, has always been vital and will always be vital. And so our work is really about healing ourselves and our people, and not about fixing the language.
Words have power to change things. When the words of a language aren't spoken, they're like a seed lying on the ground, visibly doing nothing. But inside a seed is energy waiting to be released when it's sown and watered. So similarly, when we pick up the words of our language and speak them out, that energy is released. It changes people's thoughts and perceptions. The hearts of the ancestors are conveyed in the words and the sentences. In this way, we hear from those long past and we are nourished and sustained as a people. As the next link in the chain, we must faithfully tend to our language for future generations. They will need the voice of our ancestors to understand who they are in the world as it takes shape during their lifetimes.
And so Chickasaw people's ability to nurture this seed of language has been threatened by colonization, which has resulted in language shift within our families. Between 1837 and 1839, our families were forced from their homelands in the southeast to Indian Territory, which is now known as Oklahoma.
This is a picture of my great-grandmother, and she and most of my grandfather's family passed away as a result of the removal.
In boarding schools, the children of these families learned English. And in my own family, this generation attended boarding schools within the Chickasaw Nation and were the last in my family to speak and understand Chickasha Numpa. So this photo up at the top is a picture of my great-great-grandmother with her classmates at Bloomfield Academy within the Chickasaw Nation.
The man standing in front of the wagon is my grandfather. He was sent away to the Carlisle School on the East Coast, and although it was forbidden, he still retained the language and passed it on to his older children.
Both Sherry and my families have in common a relocation from Oklahoma in the 1950s in pursuit of economic opportunity. And so as a result, we both grew up as citizens at large, which is what the Chickasaw Nation calls Chickasaw citizens who reside outside of its jurisdictional boundaries. And this photo is of my grandfather visiting with his father and brother who stayed in Oklahoma.
The picture at the bottom is my grandfather on the left and his brother on the right who passed away as a result of the removal.
And it's important to note that our family's stories are not unique. Currently, about 67% of enrolled Chickasaws reside outside of tribal territory, and many of those people are looking to connect back to the nation through the language.
While language materials are becoming increasingly more available to citizens at large, living outside tribal territory presents unique challenges. We lack population density. Therefore, interaction with other speakers requires a determined effort. As a result, we've forged our own pathways to the language.
And so at this point, Sherry's going to share her own story as an example of how she's engaging in language reclamation as a citizen at large.
I grew up hundreds of miles away from my tribe. I felt displacement from our land and the consequences of isolation from other tribal members. And I experienced the overpowering effects of prejudice from my mostly non-native community. People disparaged me with skeptical remarks about blood quantum and my physical appearance as if to somehow invalidate who I am. But in contrast, my father told me, "You're as much Chickasaw as you want to be." Through those troubling times, I have cherished memories of my father speaking and singing to me in Chickasha Numpa and telling me stories from our tribe. He told me things like how to hold your arm when you're talking about a man or an animal because it shows how their back is oriented, or how to cut off some of your words and not drag them out, which I later found out was a glottal stop.
Mm-hmm.
He always encouraged me to speak our language, but as children often do, I mainly listened. So despite my father's efforts, over the years I suffered with identity issues, wondering where I fit in the world. I felt like an indigenous foreigner, belonging nowhere. But at that pivotal time when my father passed away, I realized that I had taken for granted being able to listen to him speak. And he had been an anchor and a bridge between me and the tribe, and I realized I had a lot to lose. So innately, I knew that no matter what I did in life, I needed to pursue the language. So I forged ahead through decades of struggling to learn the language on my own instinctually, but not really knowing why I was doing this, pursuing it. But as I acquired more of the language, something unexpected happened. I began to realize that speaking Chickasha Numpa was the answer to settling my identity conflicts. And I finally understood what my father meant by, "You're as much Chickasaw as you want to be." The power in the words was affecting my life and my thoughts, and it silenced the skeptics. And no one, not even myself, could argue with who I am and where I fit in the world. Now I know that our language is a gift to us from our wise Creator, carried down to us through our ancestors and a rite of passage in this life, bridging between the past and the present. In the words and sentences, we hear the elders speak and we begin to understand how they thought and what our foundation is. And this is vital because being settled at our core liberates us to use our talents to benefit the world around us and be what we were designed to be. So in 2009, I started reaching out on Facebook, looking for others that were interested in learning Chickasha Numpa. And when the opportunity became available, I pushed myself to earn a Chickasha Numpa teaching certification. And now I teach students online several hours a week. And in our online classes, we're restoring community as speakers are interacting with each other. And as the student base continues to grow, what I envision is speakers meeting across the United States and providing opportunities for fluency. In this way, we can pass down the language to our children in a greater way than what we started with. In summary, through these experiences, I learned that language reclamation is about being family and realizing a tribe is a large family and accepting my place in it.
sharing of stories is so important to this work, because when we think about it, this type of rapid language shift is an unprecedented phenomenon. We've never experienced this before, and as a result, we've never had to go through this process of doing reclamation. And I think that stories play an important role then in how we make sense of this process as individuals and as a community. So my personal pathway towards the language steered me towards academia, where I studied Indigenous language education and linguistics. And when I was working on my dissertation, the way I sought to understand this phenomenon of why and how Chickasaw people are engaging in language reclamation as a life's pursuit, I looked towards stories. And so I worked with about 20 different people, including Sherry, who shared their stories with me. And these people, they represented different generations in the community and then different demographics, being citizens at large, living in the tribal territory. Some were students, some were professionals, so a wide variety of people. And what happened is that when I listened to these stories, I started to recognize themes. I started to see that people were making a choice to pursue language as a life's calling, and that there were three things that they had in common that motivated, enabled, and sustained this pursuit of language over a lifetime. And so the first theme that we want to talk about is a raised critical Chickasaw consciousness. And to explain what I mean by that, I want to share the words of one of our elder speakers who was telling me about why the language is important to him. And he said, "The language is in my heart. I guess it's kind of like that old saying, once an Indian, always an Indian." And then he stopped there and he said, he started laughing. And the reason that he started laughing was because he realized how absurd what he had just said was. Mm-hmm. He was taking the words of a colonizer to describe this perceived innate savagery of our people as Indians. And so he started laughing and he said, "No, once a Chickasaw, always a Chickasaw. The language is it." And so what happened there was that he recognized that language reclamation necessitates a raised consciousness of, one, the oppression of Chickasaw people, and two, a reawakening to a cultural identity in which Chickasha-Nopa is central. And this type of raised consciousness is something that Sherry and I both experienced ourselves. So for me, it was the first time that I heard Chickasha-Nopa spoken, and I was a sophomore in college doing an internship for the tribe. And the experience of not only hearing the language, but of being able to begin to speak it changed my life. So I learned how to say Chickasha Sayat, I'm Chickasaw, in the words of my ancestors, and suddenly English just felt so inadequate to express my sense of who I was. And so that moment prompted me to go back to school with a new goal of learning my language and supporting language reclamation work.
In my own experience, I endured prejudice and skeptics. But the positive effect was that it compelled me to look inside and contemplate the question, what does it truly mean to be Chickasaw? As I contemplated this question, I realized it wasn't outward appearance, it wasn't crafts, and it wasn't blood percentages. I'm Chickasaw because I am my father's daughter. I am Chickasaw because I am my grandfather's granddaughter. It came down to the heart of the family and realizing the tribe is a large family and having our own language of the heart.
The second theme is something I call Chickasha-Nopa is cultural practice. And my mentor Sheila Nicholas writes that words have a home in the context of culture, and they have meaning and they draw their strength within these contexts. And so I want to share a quote from another citizen at large learner. And she was talking about the experience of learning the language without speakers around. And she said, "It's like making dumplings. An experienced dumpling maker knows how to make them because it's the way she's always done it. If you read the recipe, though, there would be no way you could figure it out unless you had somebody there to teach you. And the reason that these words stood out to me was because I thought you could really read this another way. You could say there would be no way you could figure out the culture unless you had the language there to teach you. And so in that way, the language can be seen as a missing piece of the puzzle to living Chickasaw through a deep and full understanding of the totality of a Chickasaw way of being.
I ask my students why they want to learn the language. And in all this time, I've never had one say it's because they want to learn the linguistics of the language. Rather, they seek to express themselves in meaningful ways. And they often mention how they're putting into practice what they learn by conversing with family members, greeting people in their community, and participating in religious ceremonies by offering prayers.
And the third theme was the revaluing of language learners. And this was one that was really important, and it was one that our youth had a lot to say about. And so I want to share the words of one young man who shared his story with me. He said, "You can always have people who can bead, can always have people who can play stickball, but you can't always have people who remember the language." And so to give you a little bit of context, this young man came from a family where his relatives did beadwork. They made the stickball sticks. But nobody was doing language. And he began to see that that was his unique role that he had in his family, even though he was the youngest generation. And his family began to recognize that too. And the community as well, people began to look to him and see him as a keeper of the language. And this is important because being a keeper of the language is a gift, and it's something that not every Chickasaw person feels called to necessarily. But when they are, it's that internal recognition and the external recognition of the gift that motivates and sustains language learners' engagement in language reclamation.
Empathizing with the concerns of my students helps me better serve them as a teacher. As adult learners, they can often be doubtful about their ability to learn. And I feel it's important to have patience with them and truly believe that they can learn it. I assure them of the value of putting in the effort to learn the language and encourage them to speak without fear or intimidation.
So in thinking about this conference theme, the link between language and well-being, for us it really came down to this idea of hope. And it's a hope that emerges and grows as Chickasaw people pursue Chukashinompa as a life's calling. But it's important to note that this hope is something that's really delicate and it's precious. It's something that hasn't always been there. And so I was talking to an elder and he shared with me that he didn't want to be a language teacher for a long time. And he said, when this language thing began to be told about in the Indian communities and when younger generations began to hear the language, they began to want to learn. I told them, which is wrong, if I teach you, who are you going to speak to? There's nobody else that speaks it, and I'm not going to live forever. And what allowed this elder to say, I was wrong, was seeing this hope. He found hope in seeing younger people who began to speak the language and to become keepers of the language. And that gave him assurance that this new generation, these younger people, are going to be the ones that carry the language on after I'm gone.
Okay.
We have about 10 minutes for questions. I'll let you field the questions or comments from the audience.
I really like this metaphor of the recipe. You know, about this, if you can't just read the recipe and know how to speak the language, but unfortunately that's the case with a lot of our communities now. We just have the recipe,
mm-hmm.
you know, and but we don't have anyone to teach us necessarily, and so we're trying to do it ourselves. But I thought that was an interesting metaphor to kind of show that you need more than just a book in front of you, or even a lot of the materials that communities create are not necessarily, can't do the work that talking to people can, you know?
Right. And I think that what that gets at is that this work is really about relationships, your relationship that you have to your teacher. A lot of people in the community, like for myself, I don't have a grandparent that speaks, so these elders that speak become your new grandparent, another grandparent, and so it's really about these relationships. I mean, like Sherry and I, our relationship started because I interviewed her for my dissertation, but it's become something that, I mean, for a few years now that we've been working together, and it, that's what sustains us and moves us forward.
Two-thirds of our tribe is spread across the U.S., and so a lot of the people are isolated from one another. And I kept thinking about this problem and just realized that internet was the only real way, because people can't all move back to our tribal territory. And so the way I conduct my class is it's video conferencing, essentially. And I have 9 students per class, which I'm there, and we all see each other, we all interact, and I'm able to share the screen and show them pictures and illustrate various ways to construct a sentence, things like that. And we do a semester, 18 weeks, and I have a set curriculum of a goal that we're gonna reach at the end. And then during the class time, I also teach them prayers and greetings and various things that they can start using right away. And it really encourages them. Also, they have started connecting with one another outside of class. So they're reaching across the miles with their phones and talking. So, because the biggest complaint is I have no one to talk to. Well, I think it's good, but we have the additional challenge of being removed from the area that we were originally from, so a lot of the information is lost, and where we are is rather recent history for us, so it's challenging.
She was very reluctant to
think that's a really good point, and I think in a lot of, probably a lot of our indigenous communities, when we think about the plants, we think about them as living beings, our relatives even, and so it's hard to conceptualize, like, do you give your relative into this, like, stem framework? It's kind of an odd thing to think about, and I think maybe that's why there's some resistance.
Can I comment on that? At first contact, the Hawaiian population is estimated to be around 400,000. 90% of the people died within less than 100 years. The royalty learned to read and write through the missionaries. Once the royalty understood the power of recording through text, they actually established schools throughout Hawaii. If you could get 50 people together, the government would support a school. And the request was specifically to the people to write everything down because they saw everybody dying. As a result, we have the largest database of Hawaiian newspapers in language by people who lived and told the stories prior to Western contact. Western contact was with Captain Cook. Then there was language suppression. People were forbidden to use language from 1896 until 1978, when a constitutional convention brought back language into Hawaii. I didn't even know about the Hawaiian newspapers. They are now being used, we're using them in our NSF project to as sources of data. And we're actually publishing in scientific journals. And that is a source and a foundation for language restoration and cultural pride. So this is something to consider because it is every society is worried about that. And that is truly something that in Hawaii there is great attention paid to intellectual property, so to speak. So I just leave that there. That's how one culture responded, and every culture has to, I think, address that internally.
I think historically we've seen a lot of indigenous cultures be exploited, especially by pharmaceutical companies.
Absolutely.
And as Carrie, as you mentioned so eloquently, you know, if we think of plants as living beings, as our relatives, seeing them get exploited, especially in our lifetime, but also the thought of that being the case, that is obviously harmful to a culture and to a society.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate all of the different perspectives